call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 2:49 p.m. on Monday, January 24th, 2022. Present today are Representative Thompson, Representative Carpenter, Representative Lebon, Vice Chair Ortiz, Representative Josephson, myself, Co-Chair Merrick. Before we start, I ask that everyone please mute your cell phones. And for the committee's information, the plan is to go until 4:30 p.m. today. Today's presentation is from Callan on permanent fund performance measures and impact of ad hoc draws. Here to present, we have Greg Allen, their Chief Executive Officer and Chief Research Officer. Good afternoon, Mr. Allen. If you could please come to the table, introduce yourself for the record, and begin your presentation.
Thank you. My name is Greg Allen from Callan, and you've already told my titles there. Apologies for being late. I was been through three cities to get here. I was on the milk run this morning. I got stuck in Ketchikan.
Oh, you stopped in a good town of Ketchikan.
I stayed at the landing. And
We're used to those travels here in Southeast, so we understand. Thanks for being with us.
Good. All right. So I guess just a little bit of background. I've been modeling the permanent fund and looking at the durability of the earnings reserve and the fund itself since the late 90s, actually. So I've done a lot of this work over the years. The model's gotten better and better. But I've been asked by a bunch of different administrations to look at various things. Most recently, I was asked to look at ad hoc draws and what the effect might be on the earnings reserve and the ability of the fund to you know, meet the needs of the new POMV spending rule. So that's the second part of the presentation. The first part, I was asked to just do a little bit of a performance review on the fund and just point out a couple of things that I think are interesting.
Thank you. Let the record reflect, at 2:51 p.m. we were joined by Representative Johnson.
All right, so just in terms of performance, we typically start by giving a little bit of background to interpret the performance of the fund. These bar charts are returns for various asset classes over various time periods ended September. The performance is not finalized for December, so we're going to be looking at September, although I'll have a couple comments about the time in between then and now. I draw your attention to the one-year period. Note that small cap equities returned 47.7% for the year. They were the best returning asset class, but the large cap, U.S. large cap, was 30%, and non-U.S. equities was 24%. So a really strong year for the equity markets for the year ended September. Going back even 10 years, you can look at the large cap equity, and you can see that it's annualized. That's 16.6% for 10 years. That's almost unheard of return for a 10-year period. So it's been a really good time to be an equity investor, and the fund reflects that. A lot of our clients' portfolios reflect that. We work with a lot of big pension funds, and they're much better funded now than they were 10 years ago. So that's a little bit of backdrop.
Real quickly, Madam Chair.
Representative Ortiz.
Sorry. Could you just briefly explain the difference between large cap, small cap, what that actually means?
Sure. Okay. The large cap are the biggest companies in the economy. So think Apple, Facebook, IBM, ExxonMobil. Small cap are companies that typically have a market cap below about $3 billion. So, and there's a lot of them. There's, you know, over 2,000 of those smaller companies. And they tend to be more domestically focused, and the large companies tend to be more globally focused in terms of the markets they operate in.
Very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you. And let the record reflect, we were joined online by Representative Rasmussen at 2:52 p.m.
All right. So just a little bit more color. This is U.S. equity. This is both large and small combined now. Non-U.S. developed markets, so those are the, you know, like Europe and Japan, sort of the big developed markets. And then the emerging markets, which include China, India, and South America largely. So, again, it's been a good period, but the U.S. equity markets have dominated. And so investors that have a global focus have actually underperformed the U.S. equity market. But, you know, global is a good idea in the long run in the interest of diversification. But the difference between the U.S. markets and the non-U.S. markets is really striking over the last 10 years. So this is a kind of a busy table. I just wanted to call out a couple of things here that I think are interesting. I'll point to the one-year numbers and draw your eyes down to almost the bottom, the third row from, or the fourth row from the bottom. That's the private equity index. As you may or may not know, a permanent fund has been building out a private equity portfolio for the last almost 20 years, I believe. And they have a really successful private equity program. You can see that the return on private equities was the highest returning asset class for the one-year period ended September at 56.87%. So that was even higher than small cap stocks. So to the extent that you had private equity in your portfolio, to the extent you had small cap in your portfolio, you did very well relative to your peers. So this is our periodic table. What this represents is year by year, starting in 2012 through 2020, and the three quarters ended 2021. The box at the top was the highest performing asset class in that year. The box at the bottom was the lowest performing. And it sort of goes year by year. And the point of this chart is just to illustrate the fact that not the same thing doesn't win every year. This is really in the interest of diversification. You can see that private real estate had two good years at the top, but they've had, you know, three bad years at the bottom. U.S. large cap equity, though, over this 10-year period, has always been sort of in the top half. So again, that reflects the fact that almost anything you did outside of U.S. large cap equity probably lowered your return relative to just being invested in the U.S. market. I also plot in white the permanent funds returns for those years. And so you can see that it's always somewhere in the middle because they own all of these asset classes in varying degrees.
Thank you. Let the record reflect. At 2:55 p.m., we were joined by Representative Edgman, Representative Wool, and Representative Foster.
All right, so now we're going to talk about the fund. I apologize in advance. The first last quarter and fiscal year to date are actually the same time period. We try to avoid that and use the space more effectively. But what I show on this page and the next page is the return of the fund in blue. So that's the total return on the Alaska Permanent Fund portfolio. The green is the return on their performance benchmark. And probably more importantly, is the brown is the objective, the CPI plus 5%. And so you can see for the year, the fund was up 26.6%, CPI plus 5 was 10.39. So in terms of supporting a POMV spending rule, which is 5% of the five of the last 6 year average market value, if you had years like this every year, you could support more than 5%. Because you've exceeded the CPI significantly. If you flip to the next slide, these are the periods, these are longer periods. They're the same bars, 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, and 20 years. The permanent fund is ahead of all of its benchmarks over all of these time periods, and largely that's been on the back of really some stellar performance over the last, in particular, the last 3 years relative to benchmark. 8% annualized for 20 years. So this chart is a very popular chart in our business. Essentially what it's doing is it's showing the return ranking of the permanent fund portfolio relative to, in this case, a big database made up of large public funds over $1 billion in assets. The gray area represents the returns from the 10th at the top to the 90th percentile, so about 80% of the funds fall in between those. The blue dot is the permanent fund, and the little number next to the blue dot, next to the A, is the ranking. So fourth percentile, for example, for the year, sixth percentile for the 3 years, 12th percentile for 5 years, 38th percentile for 20 years. So what that means in the case of 20 years is that the permanent fund outperformed 62% of the funds in this universe. So again, third percentile, so outperformed 97% of the funds for the quarter. So again, these are big public funds. We also look at the permanent fund relative to endowments. So these are large endowments, largely they're all over $1 billion in assets. And you can see here that the permanent fund ranks, these are the same returns, but it's a different universe. And here the permanent fund ranks in the middle more than at the top. And the reason for that, the reason that it ranks so differently between these two universes, is endowments, large endowments, tend to make a lot of use of private equity, and so does the permanent fund. So the permanent fund's private equity exposure would actually be on the slightly on the low end of this endowment universe, but it's on the high end of the public fund universe. And so private equity is primarily the explanation. Permanent fund also has a small cap tilt in their portfolio relative to the broad market. That really helped. And the equity portfolio itself outperformed its benchmarks. That really helped. So, you know, the permanent fund has been really firing on all cylinders pretty much across the board, the fixed income fund. The real estate fund is under repair. That's probably the area that is not done as well, but things are looking up there, I think. But you know, we work with over $3 trillion in client assets. We work with a lot of big funds. These are really good results for the permanent fund. One last set of slides here. This is the standard deviation ranking. So this is now a measure of risk. How much risk did the permanent fund demonstrate over the last 3, 5, 7, 10, and 20 years relative to peers? In this dimension, arguably it's good to be low, because if you have lower risk than everybody else and higher returns, then you're a more efficient portfolio. And again, relative to the public funds, the permanent fund has low risk, high returns. Relative to the endowments, it's kind of in the middle. And again, that's a reflection of the fact that the permanent fund's portfolio looks now more like an endowment than a public fund.
Madam Co-Chair.
Representative Edgman.
Mr. Co-Chair, sorry. I heard Kelly talk. Are you taking questions?
Yes.
So this is a lot of information. It's going at about 100 miles an hour for me.
Apologies.
Good information. I really appreciate it. Can you back up for just a second? And I heard you say something about in the middle for endowments. And can you repeat that statement? And I want to get a little more context to it.
So we're looking at two universes. One is public funds, which are big pension funds. And the other is endowments. So think Yale or Harvard, or, you know, those are the big headline endowments. But there's hundreds of endowments all across the country. Endowments were earlier in the adoption of private equity, hedge funds, some of the more, some people would call exotic investment strategies out there. The public funds, on the other hand, have been slow to adopt those types of investments. The permanent fund was fairly early as a public entity to start investing in private equity, and started, I think, 15 or 18 years ago, started this private equity portfolio. And the thing about private equity is that at the beginning, it doesn't do well. You have to, it's a long-term investment. You have what's called a J curve. You lose money at first. But when private equity portfolios get mature, like the permanent funds, and you have a great couple years like we've had for the last 3 years, you get these spectacular returns. And so the endowments were in sort of the same situation as the permanent fund, in the sense that they all started early in private equity. They had fairly big exposures. And as I pointed out on the third slide, I think, private equity was the top performing asset class last year. So I think the point I wanted to get across with, and we do this with the board as well, is that when you talk about how did I do relative to peers, the permanent fund is kind of a little of both. You know, they're a public entity, but they're now become more of an endowment. You know, they're an endowment for the state of Alaska. They're there to sort of, you know, be a sustainable resource to create distributions into perpetuity, and that's what an endowment does. And the permanent fund is now invested more like the endowments that we see out there than the public funds. And that's why the returns were so good relative to public funds.
Well, if I could use a sports metaphor, I mean, 30% or whatever that number was in 1 year, you know, Wilt Chamberlain wants to average 50.1 game points a game.
Right.
It'll never be done again ever in the NBA.
Right.
I mean, is that the kind of year we're looking at that we just went through, or?
You know, in some senses, I would say it's definitely the kind of decade that we've looked at, we've been looking at. You know, coming off of the great global financial crisis in 2008 and going into 2009, it's just been more or less straight up since then, and particularly for the equity markets. And that's been good for private equity. That's been good for the permanent funds portfolio and for all of our clients' portfolios. I think in general, we believe that you should be invested in equity if you're a long-term investor, like the permanent fund. It is the highest performing asset class over the long run, and we think private equity is the highest form of that. But you do need to be diversified. But yeah, this has been an extraordinary 13-year period relative to history. I'm not predicting, and I don't think most people are, that it's all going to come crashing, burning to the ground next year. I think most of the financial world is actually looking at next year as being a relatively robust year. But it has been a really, I don't know if it's Wilt Chamberlain 50 points a game kind of a year, but it was a pretty good year.
Representative Ortiz and then Representative LeBron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And again, reflecting my own illiteracy in this particular area, but can you give me a little bit better definition of what it means to be invested in private equity?
Sure. So when I talked about large cap stocks and small cap stocks, you know, big companies and smaller companies, generally we're referring to stocks where you can, where their ownership is publicly traded. You can buy it and sell it on the exchange literally in milliseconds, right? And there are hedge funds that do that kind of stuff. Private equity is more like, hey, trying to think of a good story, but I guess the way to think about it, think of a brand new company that is just starting up. You know, somebody has a really good idea. They want to make some kind of widget that's going to change the world. They don't have any capital, and they need a lot of capital to get this thing off the ground and make it for through the first 3 to 5 years where they're not going to be making any money. The private equity investors are looking for deals like that, and they go out and fund these companies. So that would be called venture capital. So that's one form of it. So those companies, they're buying interests in those companies. That's not publicly traded. They're going straight to the founders and saying, here's $100 million and I want 20% of your company. They're betting that over time, these guys are going to execute, the company's going to grow, and pretty soon they're going to be able to sell it into the public markets and make a colossal amount of money. And private equity generally works where you have, you know, one home run and 10 zeros. Because they're investing in very risky companies, but they're diversifying across a lot of companies. So that's one form. There are other forms, but basically it's private ownership. You're not necessarily subject to the same regulatory oversight as you would be with a public company. You can have a little more freedom. You can have a little bit longer time horizon. You don't have shareholders that are bugging you every quarter. What are my earnings this quarter? They can wait. They're patient. So your money's tied up, importantly. In the private markets, you can't get your money out. You can't turn around and sell. If you get panicked and you try to sell a private investment, you're going to take a haircut on it. So you got to be patient, and you got to be long-term, and you've got to be in a position like the permanent fund is, where you don't need your capital right now, and you earn a premium for all of that.
Okay, thank you very much.
Representative LeBron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And actually, that was my question, was going to ask you to give a little bit of a definition for a private equity investment. That was a good explanation. The Alaska Permanent Fund is a very hands-on investment organization, if you will, that we make a lot of these investment decisions on our own. We're not a passive investor that ties to an index fund. And private equity investments is a good example. We have to have the talent and the experience on staff to look at these opportunities and make good decisions.
Correct.
And would you have an opinion about the ability of Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation to make good decisions in that arena?
Yeah, I do have an opinion about that. I've been amazed, actually, at the ability of the permanent fund to build and maintain the staff that they have. I think it's challenging. You know, not everybody wants to live in Juneau. You're competing against, you know, both coasts, where there's a lot of demand for investment talent. But you've got, actually, at kind of the investment staff level, you've got a really stable group of people. I mean, Marcus Frampton, I mean, we know them all, and many of them have been there a decade or more. You've got a really good group right now. I don't know if I can tell you, do you have a sustainable model where you'll have a good group the next 10 years? I think every public fund that we deal with has to compete for talent. And, you know, they can't necessarily pay as much as the private sector. And so that's always a challenge in maintaining the type of staff that the permanent fund has. So, you know, right now, at least, I think you've got the best staff you've ever had. I mean, we've been working with the permanent fund for over 30 years, and I've personally been working with the permanent fund since 1992, I think, was the first project I did. And, you know, it's gotten better every year. But you do have a really great group of people there right now. I think you have you've had a fair number of CIOs over the last 6 or 7 years, and finally you looked inward, and I think you've got a really great CIO in Marcus Frampton. So I think you're well positioned to be able to do the due diligence that you do need to do on private equity.
Hello.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman, for a follow-up. Along that same line, recruiting and retaining talent in that arena, does the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation have a, in your opinion or your judgment, a good bonus program for success, or are we average, or are we below average? How would you rate our performance bonus program for the high achievers in that area?
You know, I would say it's better than your average public fund for sure. Public funds, pension funds, typically don't even pay performance bonuses. So the fact that I don't know how long ago that was installed, but I feel like it was relatively recently at the permanent fund, I think that's a big help. I would say that working for the permanent fund in some ways, if you're in this business, is a reward in and of itself. You get to, if you're in the position of Steve Mosley, for example, you're looking at some of the best and most important deals that anybody in our business gets to look at on a regular basis. You're working with the absolute best investment managers in the industry. They're flying out here, some of them private, to talk to you in person. The permanent fund can get these folks to show up at any board meeting that they want. So there's a certain amount of prestige that comes with working at the permanent fund, and I think that's another a really attractive part of the fund itself. There are not too many $80 billion sovereign wealth funds around, and it's particularly ones that have such a good investment program.
Please, I've got two questions, Representative Wold and Representative Edgman.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chairman. On these annualized risk rankings, the permanent fund is low risk compared to other public entities, but it seems like, and compared to earnings too, obviously the private equity is paying off a bigger yield, but it comes with higher risk. Is that basically the trade-off? And these risk levels that are sort of in the middle is kind of where they feel comfortable and more comfortable than a private endowment. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I guess this is going to be a little bit potentially confusing, but I'm going to go ahead and try it anyway. So private equity is more risky than public equity, in the sense that you can lose 100% of your investment. It's more likely, not 100% of a giant private equity portfolio, but the individual companies can go bankrupt. Generally, however, because it's not publicly traded, it's not priced every single day. And so when you look at a measure like standard deviation, private equity actually looks less risky than public equity because it's not being priced every day. You're kind of getting it valued every once in a while. It's kind of like real estate, right? So part of the reason that the permanent fund looks like it has low risk relative to the public funds, it ranks in the bottom in risk, even though it's got more private equity, which is higher risk. So that's what's a little bit confusing here, right? So, but private equity is the explanation actually for the reason it has higher returns than public funds and the reason it has lower risk, because private equity gets marked to market, you know, once a quarter, and it tends to be smoothed out. It doesn't look as sharp as the markets themselves. So it kind of is this magic dust. Now, you know, if everything goes down, private equity is going to go down by more eventually, okay? So it kind of disguises, you don't see the risk that is there inside of private equity through these metrics. But I put these in here and for the board just to help everyone understand that if you rank in the middle, that means you look more like that universe than this universe. But historically, the permanent fund has always compared itself against big public funds. And I'm just thinking, you know, the asset allocation has kind of drifted from the big public fund model to the endowment model. I will say that the public funds are on their way. they're coming in this direction as well, but they're behind. They're probably 8 years behind the permanent fund.
Thank you. Representative Edgman?
So the Alaska legislature in 2018 adopted the POMB concept, and the first 3 years of its application were 5.25%. I think we're in year four now, at 5.0%. Is there a way that you could share with me how, comparatively speaking with other endowments who don't have a POMB set that at a 5% rate or whatnot? My understanding is that there's a number of sovereign wealth funds around the world that have a POMB concept but set at a lower rate, 4%, or maybe even at 3% or what have you. But the fact that we're now in year four at 5.0%, how would you incorporate that relative to the risk incurred? I mean, you know, some years are golden like this year,
right?
In fact, but some years down the road are going to be pretty pedestrian in terms of earnings, returns,
or negative.
Still paying 5% out,
right?
How would you tell us at the committee level? How do you incorporate that in terms of risk and performance?
So the lower the draw. So if you went to 3%, the permanent fund could afford to take less risk and still meet the 3% objective over the long run. So there's two kinds of risk. There's not meeting the objective next year, and there's not meeting the objective 20 years from now. 5% of the first 5 years of the last 6 years does not result in 5%. It's less because the markets generally are going up. So we've calculated that, you know, sort of on average, that's more like a 4.6% draw of the most recent market value, on average, okay? We believe that the current formula combined with the current asset allocation is sustainable over the long run in the sense that you will ultimately have about a 50% chance of either being above or below that 5% return over the long run, or 5% plus inflation. So the point of a typical endowment is only to take as much out as you need to preserve the purchasing power for the next generation. So you have to adjust it for inflation, right? $100 today is not the same as $100 tomorrow. $100 tomorrow is less. So there needs to be enough in there to cover the 5%, which is actually 4.6, right? Plus the inflation over the long run, which we think is about 2.25. So can the permanent fund do 4.6 plus 2.25 over the long run? We think that's right about the middle. If the permanent fund staff or the board were to decide, hey, we need to de-risk this thing and take the private equity out and maybe take some equity off the table and put it back into bonds, you know, bonds are yielding 1.75% right now. If you kept paying out 5% and you were all in bonds, you'd run out of money. You couldn't do it. So as long as the draw is 5% of the first five of the last 6 years, which is 4.6%, the permanent fund's going to need to maintain a risk posture that looks like your typical endowment. And the reason I think that they're in the middle is your typical endowment is right around that same level of draw, 4.5 to 5% of market value. So I think the world generally believes that's a sustainable amount, but you're absolutely right. There are going to be years and potentially multiple years, and I'm going to show you in this simulation what it potentially could look like. But to me, the biggest risk is not the POMV. The biggest risk is the legacy constitutional language around the earnings reserve. That's an old way of doing things, this concept of principal and an earnings reserve. And in our view, at least, the POMV formula is a better way of doing it. It's not like you hit this cliff and then all of a sudden you can't spend at all. I mean, if the ERA runs out of money, you could get to zero, a zero draw. The ERA is in direct conflict with the POMV. It's not right now. Right now, you got a big ERA. And not only that, you got a bunch of unrealized gains in the fund that if those get sold, that'll add to the ERA. And I can jump into my presentation and into the next section. Would that be all right, where I go over all this stuff?
But, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Vision.
Thank you for kind of slowing this down a little bit. I was a finance major in college, so I can track some of this stuff, but this is really rapid-fire information. I think it's helpful to put it in real-world context so we kind of can, you know, follow you.
Yeah. All right, I will try my best. So this next section is now looking forward. Callan built and maintains a model of the permanent fund that allow us to simulate its behavior into the future across thousands of simulations, some of them really bad, some of them really good, and kind of generate a whole range of what might the world look like with probabilities associated with it. That's what I'm about to talk about now. We built this back in the 90s, late 90s. I think Jim Kelly was around then. I think Byron Malott, maybe. There was a habit, or it happened a couple times, maybe, where there was a temptation to take everything out of the ERA at the end of the year and appropriate it to principal and start the year with a zero ERA. And they wanted to understand, you know, what's the risk that you wouldn't be able to pay a dividend by doing that. And so I did some modeling, and that was the genesis of this. So I've been testing the durability of the ERA for 20-plus years using this model, so that you can see what happens, not just in the middle, but what happens in what we call the corner cases, you know, the really bad outcomes. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that. So to go into it, I'm just going to review a couple of the accounting concepts around the permanent fund, talk a little bit about the history of the appropriation and the market value and so forth. Then I'm going to talk about some scenarios that we looked at where maybe more money was pulled out than the in addition to the POMV. We called them ad hoc draws. And then we're going to look at the range of outcomes. So I'll try to go slowly, and if you have questions, please jump in.
I had a question, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I shouldn't probably know this, but I was wondering, just before we got into that section, if you would just talk about your relationship with the permanent fund, who you are, and a little bit, just give me a little bit of background. You're talking about being involved for a number of years, but I'm afraid that I'm new to this committee, and I'd like to hear about a little bit of your history, if you would, if it's all right. Thanks.
Sure. Okay, so Callan is the company I work with. We are consultants to big funds like the Permanent Fund. Our job is to essentially advise the board and to assist the staff with various things. So probably the board most regularly sees us in the role of coming in and commenting on the performance. So we have, Permanent Fund's one of our most complicated clients, so we have a team of analysts that calculate the performance on the Permanent Fund, not just the total return, but the return on every little piece of the fund, and we break it down, and we come in and we talk about how did the private equity portfolio do, how did the equity portfolio do, how did the international equity portfolio, the real estate portfolio, and why. And we help the board understand that. We help the permanent fund staff. Sometimes they're looking for an investment manager to do X, Y, or Z. We have a big database. We follow all of the investment managers in the United States and globally, track all kinds of numbers about them, and we do what are called searches. So we conduct a process to help them select the best investment manager for each job along the way. We do help them with the board decide about asset allocation. How much risk should they take? Can they support the POMV draw? We do this modeling for the board so they can understand what if this, what if that. We've helped them install a currency overlay program. We've done a lot of different projects for them over the years. But we've worked with the Permanent Fund Board as well as the RMB Board for over 30 years now.
Question, Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Just real quick, do you have people in your company that are permanently assigned to the permanent fund, and that's the only client that they have?
Typically, so there's the lead consulting team, which I'm one of, and Steve Center, who's, I think, on the phone right now, is the other. So we're at every quarterly board meeting, he and I. And I've been coming for about 10 or 12 years now in that capacity. And prior to that, I used to come in just to show this model. We have two performance analysts that are assigned to the permanent fund, where that's one of their clients. But I have a few other clients. Steve has other clients. So no, there's nobody that's 100% devoted to the permanent fund.
Please continue.
All right. So what I'm going to talk about now is just give a little review of some of the important accounting concepts for the permanent fund. And I'm going to start with statutory net income. Statutory net income is the lifeblood of the earnings reserve account. Without any statutory net income, there would be no earnings reserve. It's essentially all of the income that has been realized by the permanent fund minus all of the appropriation, minus all the distributions. Okay, so since the beginning of time. So statutory income comes from a couple places. Think about coupons from bonds. You buy a bond, they pay you, you know, $10 a month. That becomes statutory net income. That $10 gets added. Dividends from stocks. So rent payments from real estate. Those are all income. But the other component of statutory net income is when a stock goes up, so you bought it for 100, and it's worth 120, and you sell it, that 20 is called a realized gain. That goes into statutory net income. Okay? Why is that important, and why is it particularly important right now? When you have 10 years where the equity markets are up, you know, 16% a year, if you bought something 10 years ago and you haven't sold it yet, there's a lot of potential energy in that investment, where if you were to sell it, a bunch of statutory net income. The fund has never in our history had as much unrealized gains sitting there as it has right now, relative to the size of the fund, and I'll show you that in a minute. So statutory net income is what feeds the earnings reserve account.
Got a question, Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize for jumping in a little bit here. You mentioned selling an asset. Maybe it held that asset for 10 years, get a nice gain. The original principal on that investment, that $100, is returned to the principal of the fund.
Right.
But 10 years from now, inflation has impacted the value of that $100.
Yeah.
So that's one of the reasons why it's important to add back and inflation-proof the principal from time to time. Would that be a fair?
Yeah, absolutely.
Statement?
Given the formula and the concept of earnings reserve and principal, if you didn't inflation-proof, there's definitely not enough. I mean, the oil revenue is pretty small relative to the size of the fund now. So inflation-proofing is an important concept if you want to keep the purchasing power of the principal even over time. All right, this is a really complicated slide, I realize. I apologize, but this is the earnings reserve account. So the earnings reserve account, in very simple terms, if you've got $100 in total market value of the fund, principal is one component, and anything that's left over is earnings reserve. So earnings reserve and principal split the market value of the fund. That's the simplest way of looking at it. There's a formula for determining what the earnings reserve is. It's the earnings reserve at the beginning of the year, plus any statutory net income, minus any appropriations back to principal, so moving it from one bucket to the other, minus any distribution out of the fund. So if you start with $100, and you have $10 in statutory net income, you're at 110. You appropriate 20 back to principal, now you're down to 90. You pay out 5, now you're down to 85. Okay, so it's actually fairly simple, plus minus. Right now, at the end of fiscal year, this should say 2020, apologies for that, the ending earnings reserve balance was $21.2 billion. To put that in context, you have a draw using the PLMV formula of roughly $3.7 billion. The earnings reserve can clearly cover the draw. Okay. So I want to give you a little history. These are actual values going back about 10 years. There's statutory net income. Okay, so remember, it's the income from the bonds, the dividends, and then any unrealized gains that were realized in that year. 2021 was a big year for realizing gains. They had some private equity investments that they sold. They had a real estate deal that they sold. $8 billion in statutory net income in 2021. You can see that the normal levels are around three and a half, something like that. You know, pretty much equal to what the draw is projected to be. But you have those big outlier years, 2018, 2021. There were extraordinary events, particularly in the private markets portfolio, that created a bunch of unrealized, turned unrealized gains into realized gains. Here's the earnings reserve balance. You can see back in 2012, there was only $2 billion in the earnings reserve. So it hasn't always looked this good. 2012, you didn't have a POMV. You were paying a dividend formula back then, which is a much smaller draw. But look at 2021. You know, there's that $21.2 billion in there. You can see that 4.8 of that is unrealized gains. So some of the unrealized gains get allocated to earnings reserve. So the biggest it's ever been. And that's in spite of a $4 billion appropriation to principal that happened, I think, in 2019. The beginning of 2020. Here's the principal balance. You can see it, you know, that again, that 2020, that's that $4 billion going in there from 2019 to 2020. It was flat in 2021, no inflation proofing in 2021. But you can see that dark blue, those are the unrealized gains that are allocated to the principal. They're bigger as a percentage of principal than they've ever been. There's the market value. Look at that big jump in market value from 2020 to 2021. That's that incredible return that you guys, that I was showing you. So those are a little bit of history, just to give you a sense of scale. I'm going to talk a little bit about what I started to talk about at the beginning, which is this model, which is we call Monte Carlo simulation. And essentially, to make it as simple as I can, instead of just looking at one outcome, you know, what if the fund returns 6.2% every year for the next 10 years? You know, we do look at that, and that's what's often used for projections. What we do instead is we come up with 2,000 different scenarios for stocks, bonds, interest rates, inflation, currencies. We create 2,000 future worlds that go out 10 years, each with kind of a probability associated with it. So we can kind of see in action what happens when things get really bad, what happens when things are good. And then we'll stack all that up and hopefully make some sense of it for you. So.
Got a question, Representative Josephson?
Yes, through the chair. This is very helpful, and I, you're Mr. Allen.
Yes, correct.
And I don't, my question isn't meant to second guess you, it's to clarify and understand. But looking at slide 18, for example, on the historical earnings reserve account, if you add the realized and unrealized, you're at about $21 billion.
Yeah.
But the permanent fund is reporting last Thanksgiving, so 2 months ago. They're saying the ERA total is 15.7, and the uncommitted is 8.9. And they get to the 8.9 by backing out their the anticipated draw we're about to do, I think, and the unrealized part. So should I, if I meet the man on the street and he says, how much is the ERA? Do I tell him 8.9 or do I tell him 20? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, so this is the end of 2021. I believe on the first day of 2022, there was a $4 billion moved out of the ERA, another $4 billion, right? The second $4 billion. So I would say that at the beginning of fiscal year 2022, which was July 1st, just passed, it's no longer 21.2 or whatever. I think that's what that adds up to. It's now that minus $4 billion. So that would be the number I would at the beginning of the year. Now things change, But I think for the purposes of reporting, they report the earnings reserve at the end of each fiscal year. I know that since July 1st, there's actually been a bunch more unrealized gains. realized gains. They had all those unrealized gains, and they've been rebalancing the portfolio and selling and realizing gains. So it's probably larger than that number minus $4 billion at this point in time. And we can certainly ask the CFO from the permanent fund to comment on the current estimate of the ERA balance.
Just to follow up. For a number of years, we heard that it was good to have three times the draw in the ERA as the total realized amount net of any pending draw, I guess. And so when I see that number 8.9 that I mentioned, that seems to be the three times the draw, and that's sort of that looks comfortable to me. The legislature a couple of years ago had talked about, a colleague of mine from Sitka had proposed moving $8 billion or something, $9 billion out of the earnings reserve, and I thought that was too much. But I don't know if there's a question in there or if you want to respond.
Well, I'd be happy to comment on my thoughts on that. As long as your goal is to be able to spend the POMV formula, the more in the ERA, the better. The ERA is kind of an artificial concept, and I think it's somewhat of an irrelevant concept now that you've moved to a POMV endowment model. If there was one thing that you guys collectively could do as legislators, you would, in my opinion, that would do the best thing for the endowment that you're managing now, would be to constitutionalize the spending rule. Get rid of the ERA, get rid of the concept of principle, and just constitutionalize not only the formula, but the percentage. Because right now, as I understand it, depending on the mood of the legislature, you can spend whatever you want as long as it's in the ERA. The spending, having spending moving around or having it be uncertain for the folks over at the permanent fund is a distraction. Most big endowments don't have an ERA and a principal. They have a spending rule, and they know well in advance what they're going to be able to spend at the end of next year, and you can't violate that. I know it's a big ask to try to get something changed in the Constitution, so I may be talking crazy California talk, but right now the ERA, the bigger the better, because it doesn't get in the way of the spending rule, right? If you were to appropriate, you know, $15 billion out of the ERA on the theory that that'll stop future legislators from spending the money, you're solving one potential problem, but you're potentially creating a much larger problem, which is you're going to get to the end of a year where the markets are down 20%, and there'll be nothing left in the ERA. And not only that, you'll be sitting on some unrealized losses. So that means when they sell, it's not, you know, it's going to wipe out the effect of the income. So having a really small ERA or having an ERA of three times, three times is comfortable. Four times would be better. Five times would be better. But all of that assumes that people don't spend more than they should. So that's the other side of it, is having the discipline to not spend more than 5% of the first 5 years of the last 6 years. If you decide you want to spend an extra $3 billion or an extra $2 billion, you know, that hurts the value of the fund. And that's basically taking money from the future and giving it to the present. So if you could have a rule and nobody violated the rule and everybody knew what the rule was, you wouldn't argue about how much you spend, you wouldn't argue about how much to appropriate. It would make that whole process really simple. But anyway, enough of an editorialism from me.
I know that we have a long way to go and I don't want to get bogged down. But there's an interesting word he used and I want to ask him about it. The word was distraction. Is your concern that because it's not constitutionalized, it's a distraction to the staff down the street, that is the investors, or is it a distraction to those we're investing with? I mean,
as long as you stick to the rule, the permanent fund staff knows well in advance how much cash they're going to have to raise to meet the draw. But if suddenly you come in and say, no, we need $3 billion more, you know, they can get it done, but it's just they're going to have to sell things potentially at inconvenient times to fund the draw. So it kind of, so the uncertainty of not knowing how much is going to be spent in any given year is never a good thing for an investment staff, particularly managing a long-term portfolio like this.
Okay. Representative Rasmussen?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Coach. So I guess my question was, we have political realities before us as policymakers, and I appreciate the expert testimony that you're providing today, but my question is, would there be a way to quantify, I guess, the benefit to the fund in the long term if we were to do a one-year overdraw, I guess, of the ERA, if you will, as part of an overall grand bargain to transfer all of the ERA into the principal instead of POMB on the entire fund rather than how it's set up now?
So I understand your question, or at least the first part, which is there a way to quantify the impact of a one-time extra draw? I think that was the question you asked, and that's what I've attempted to do here, is to show you from a bunch of dimensions, which is still coming, what if you did that? And I looked at is that your question?
Through the chair, could I have a follow-up?
Follow-up.
Thank you. So I guess what I'm asking is there a way to quantify like the benefit in the long term if we were to collapse all of the permanent fund into one account? As part of an overall grand bargain, we may have to make a concession of a one-time overdraw. But in the long term, obviously, as you've stated, it's more beneficial to have this constitutionalized. We just have political, I guess, compromise, I think, that would need to happen in order for that to take place.
All right, yeah.
So we would take a hit at this point by overdrawing for a year, but knowing that there's surety in the future that wouldn't happen again.
Yeah, I think in the simplest terms, I think that the benefit will be that it's going to take some of these worst-case scenarios off the table that I'm about to show you. And so I'll keep that question in mind and answer it when I get to some of these slides, because I think when I have the slides in front of me, it's going to make it real clear what the benefit of getting rid of the ERA construct and going to a straight POMV would do. So I'll skip ahead here because I'm getting behind. Just a little history lesson there. So just to try to get across what a simulation looks like, this is what a simulation doesn't look like. This is getting essentially the same return year after year after year. This is what is usually done when people model things financially. They say, what's the average return? Okay, we're just going to get the average return every year. With a portfolio like the permanent fund, there's never been 10 years in a row where it's gotten the same return. There's never even been 2 years in a row where it's gotten the same return. You've got to have volatility to reflect reality. Under that really nice scenario like you had right there, the earnings reserve, you don't even need to worry. The earnings reserve is going to be fine. It never goes down or up. What I want to show you next is, you know, one of these kind of bad scenarios. What's a bad scenario for the permanent fund, and particularly for the spending rule? That's what it looks like. It's trial number 178 of our 2,000 trials. I just went and I can see them all. I went in and picked one of the ones that's pretty bad. There's maybe a 3% chance of this happening or something like that. So what happens here? In 2022, you actually have a decent year, up 7%. So not too bad. This has been an okay year. Then you have 2023, 24, 25, and 26, four bad years in a row, all negative, 10%, 7%, 8%, 9%. The bad case scenarios for the permanent fund isn't just one bad year, like 2008. Generally speaking, if 2008 is followed by 2009, the ERA is going to be fine, permanent fund is going to be fine. The bad cases for the permanent fund are multiple negative years in a row, or negative years and really low returning years. So you notice here you go 23, 24, 25, 26. You get a little bit of reprieve in 27, but not really. And then 28, man, you get hit by minus 18. All right, so this, I'll show you what happens. There's your statutory net income. It actually goes negative. You run out of all those unrealized gains. And then you start realizing losses. And when you realize losses, those go against the income that's coming from the coupons and wipes it out. You got nothing coming in to feed the ERA after 4 years. There goes your earnings reserve balance. It goes to zero in 2028. What happens when you have a zero earnings reserve balance? How much can you pay? You can pay zero. All right? This is the problem with the ERA. Okay? The problem with the ERA is it can go to zero, and it can limit the POMV all the way to zero in this case. That's not going to be good for the state. That's going to put a lot of pressure on everybody to do something. Maybe that's what you need to get the Constitution changed. I don't know. But that's what's the problem with the ERA. Now, this is, by the way, starting with the ERA, the biggest it's ever been relative to the draw, and starting with a bunch of unrealized gains, which are kind of like dry powder in the portfolio. So, I mean, the ERA is even bigger than it seems because when you start selling, you're going to realize those gains. So you're starting in pretty much the best position. Now, again, this is like less than 5% chance that we think this is going to happen, but this is the kind of thing that can happen. If this happened and you didn't have an ERA, you'd still be able to spend. It would be 5% of the previous 5 years. You know, the market value would be coming down. The draw would go down, but it would be going down in a very predictable way. Everybody could get ready for it. You wouldn't hit that cliff where the ERA runs out of money and you got a zero. Anything you do to reduce the robustness of the ERA through appropriations increases the severity of the situation. It seems like it's a good idea because it hides the money or tucks it away where nobody will ever get their hands on it. But it does increase the severity of what happens under a scenario like that. So there's what happens with the distribution. First couple years, the POMV formula is working fine. The ERA is not getting in the way of it. And then all of a sudden, in 2027, you're spending less than you were planning to. And then in 28, you're spending a lot less than you're planning to. And in 29, you're not spending anything at all. So that's just one out of 2,000. There's plenty of other good ones. But I thought it was instructive just to see what happens in the really bad ones. So we run a whole bunch of scenarios, and we end up with a distribution. You've seen these bell curves before. The middle is the most likely cases, you know. And in the middle, we think there's, you know, likely to be, you know, $21 billion in the ERA at the end of 2028. Trial 178, though, that's the one where there's zero, and there's, you know, roughly a little less than 5% chance of that happening in our worlds that we've created. All right, so what we did is we modeled five different potential scenarios here in terms of taking extra money out of the fund and making one-time or two-time or three-time distributions. So the base case is the blue bars, and these are the draws. We have three other cases, or four other cases. The yellow bar is just a one-time $5 billion draw in 2022 in addition to the POMV. In the other three cases, it's $1 billion in case one, $1 billion in 2022. In case two, it's $1 billion in 22, $1 billion in 23. And in case three, it's $1 billion, $1 billion, $1 billion. All right, so you can see this is the median outcome of these 2,000 scenarios. And the reason I do it kind of year by year is so you can see the relationship. So basically, the bigger the draw, the smaller the future draws. Kind of makes sense, right? There's less money. POMV formula is smaller. You're going to pay out less. So if you take out money today, you're going to pay out less in the future in the median case. I also show you the same chart in kind of the worst case. This is the 95th percentile case in each year. So you can see a bunch of money comes out with the $5 billion. And it's the first one to run out of money or at least hit up against an ERA wall in 2026. So taking the money out now does increase the chance in a bad set of markets that you're going to hit up against that wall where you're going to be very restricted by the size of the ERA. So that's one of the effects of taking out the $5 billion but keeping the ERA. If you can take out the $5 billion and you get rid of the ERA, you know, then you will be paying out less in the future than you would have been if you didn't take the $5 billion, but at least you don't hit the cliff, right? That's the bargain. Statutory net income, you can see, here's an interesting thing. If you have to take out another $5 billion, Marcus is going to have to sell $5 billion worth of securities, and he's going to realize a bunch of gains. So your statutory net income is going to go up in 2022 relative to the base case, even though you just spent a bunch of money. You got to get it from somewhere, so you got to go sell a bunch of stocks. They were bought for 100, you're selling them for 120. That's a gain, goes right into the statutory net income bucket, goes into the ERA. So ironically, the $5 billion draw kind of helps the ERA a little bit with a little boost. But you can see that statutory net income goes down in the future because there's less assets to grow income off of. Worst case scenario, you know, in some ways, they're all kind of the same in terms of statutory net income. I mean, they're a couple $100 million difference maybe. But in the worst case, it's just it's bad for every one of these scenarios that we're looking at. It's the markets that cause the problem, not the draw. Earnings reserve balance, you can see the blue line is the one, you know, the base case, the blue bars. Earnings reserve is healthier by $5 billion compared to the $5 billion draw case. Kind of what you'd expect. Worst case, earnings reserve balance, you can see that they all start to run out of money, but the $5 billion draw runs out sooner, substantially sooner than the base case. Market value, kind of what you'd expect. I guess the one thing that I would point out about market value is, I'll point this out in another place, actually. Save that thought. Ironically, in the worst case, pulling out the $5 billion before the market goes down, you don't lose as much money. you suffer the same negative percentage return, but there's less there to lose. So it's kind of like you locked that money in, and it avoided the downdraw. So that's sort of an ironic thing about pulling money off the table. So I felt like this was a good variable to look at. This is the probability of hitting up against a scenario where the ERA doesn't allow you to pay out what you'd like to. What's the probability of a shortfall? It doesn't quantify the amount of the shortfall. It just says if there's a shortfall, chalk that up as a shortfall scenario and tell me the percentages. So just taking 2027 as an example, in the column on the left, that year, going across the rows, there's a 7% chance, even in the base case, that by 2027, you may run into a shortfall. That doesn't mean it's zero. It means that maybe the formula says $3.5 billion and you can only pay 3.2. Okay. There's essentially twice as much of a chance at 15% if you take the $5 billion out that you're going to hit up against a shortfall. Cumulative shortfall over 10 years. So this is the total amount that formula wanted you to pay minus the amount that you were able to pay. So you can see, again, there's about a 70% chance that there'll be some kind of shortfall under the $5 billion case, and it'll add it all up, it's about $1 billion less than the formula would say. But you can see the base case actually has some chance of a cumulative shortfall, you know, a 5% chance of, you know, cumulatively over 10 years falling about $7 billion short. So you can't rule out a shortfall without ruling out the ERA. All right, I'm almost done here. This is just the distribution in year 10. Basically, the $5 billion ad hoc draw case, 10 years out, it's going to cost, the PLMV formula will generate a distribution that's about $300 million less. So you get your $5 billion today, but you're going to have $300 million less in each year going forward. Cumulative distributions over 10 years. So this, I just added up all the distributions under all these scenarios for each. And so turns out that the total distribution over 10 years, if you take $5 billion out in the first year, even though you lose $300 million a year in distributions, when you add it all up, you distribute more. So it takes more than 10 years for that $5 billion to hurt your distributions enough where it's worse than the base case. That's, and I'm getting to the end here. I can sense that it's probably gone way over the top. And I'm going to try and tie all this back. I think this is an important concept. This is the market value. If you just take that top row, I haven't been focusing on the best case outcomes, but you can see that the base case has a market value of $185 billion at the end of the 10th year. The $5 billion case has a market value of $173 billion. That's $11 billion difference in market value, even though you only pulled out five more. Okay? That's the power of compounding. If that $5 billion isn't there to compound over the last 10 years that we just had, it's going to cost you a lot more than $5 billion. Statutory net income, I'm going to skip over that, and I'm going to summarize. So, relative to the base case, the ad hoc draw will reduce future market values. It will reduce statutory net income, reduce POMV distributions, reduce the earnings reserve balance, and increase the probability of shortfalls. It will weaken the fund.
Got a question.
You're in good shape right now. So should I stop?
Oh,
good.
Maybe we've got a question, Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm ready to vote. Let's go. Let's vote. Can you go back to slide 43 for a second? I think it's 43.
Sure.
One more, please. Sorry, one more back. That one there. So
yeah.
I just needed to clarify the numbers that you were talking about up there. You said 184, and you were talking about the 5%, the upper left-hand corner, right? And
yep.
And 173 being the upper right-hand corner.
Yep.
And those are, that's $184 billion?
That's $184 billion. So right now we're at about 81 or 82 billion. I don't know what we were yesterday. It's higher than that. But, yeah, so this is a best-case scenario. This is a 1 in 20, like, home run kind of a 10-year period.
That's what I was getting at. Thank you.
In the median, which is the middle 50th percentile, kind of 50% chance it's going to be better or worse than that, the base case will be at $101 million, and the $5 billion draw will be at $95 billion. So there, it's a $6 billion difference for a $5 billion draw. You kind of gave up $1 billion of gains at the end of 10 years by taking that draw out this year. And that's, we would generally focus on the middle one and not the top one, but I just wanted to make it exciting at the end.
Representative Edgman?
Significant role, but in consultation with the chief executive officer relative to investment decisions. Is that a normal process in other comparable endowments?
Interestingly, we were just working on a project looking at that that we'll be presenting at the February board meeting to the board, so if you want to tune in. And we looked at governance structures for about 25 different big funds to see what the roles were for the chief investment officer, the CEO or the executive director, the investment committee, the board. And I would say that it's a pretty common structure to have the executive director or CEO involved in investment decisions. There are funds out there where the CIO and the CEO operate pretty independently. I mean, they work together, but the CIO focuses on investments and the executive director focuses on, in the case of a pension fund, you know, benefit payments and, you know, the actuary and running the operation and hiring and staffing and IT support and all that, and the CIO just focuses on investments. But I would say that in probably the majority, over 50% of the cases where we looked at it, the CEO and the CIO, the CEO typically has veto power over over big investment decisions. There are schemes where anything smaller than a certain size, the CIO can do without vetting it. So there's different governance rules. But I think from our perspective, the permanent fund is definitely not an outlier relative to other big funds in terms of the governance structure and the role of the CEO versus the CIO.
Well, what?
So the Alaska Permanent Fund as a sovereign wealth fund is one of a kind, right, in terms of its paying individual dividends to Alaska residents, but other endowments pay dividends or outlays, right, sort of comparably, it's just not the individual,
right,
residents. Is that a fair statement?
I don't know if there are others that were smart enough to pay a dividend. I mean, I honestly think if they, so I work with the North Dakota Legacy Fund a little bit. I'm not on the account, but I've spent a fair amount of time. So they just started that one, I don't know, about 8 years ago. It's up to about $8 billion. And they don't pay a dividend, and I don't think there's very many people in the state of North Dakota that know what the Legacy Fund is or why it's there or what it's doing. And there's some politics around it now. They want to take 20% of it and invest it in in-state investments that don't meet the fiduciary standard. They've actually, in the legislation, relaxed the fiduciary standard for in-state investments. I don't know what's going to come out of all that, but that wouldn't have happened up here. Right now, the money that comes out of that goes to fund the government. And I think that most people in the state just look at it as another government account, kind of like the constitutional budget reserve. I didn't hear a lot of complaining when that got evaporated up here. I don't follow it as closely as you guys do, but I don't think the state of Alaska had the same place in their heart for the CBR as they do the permanent fund.
So earlier you said that you've got to have volatility to reflect reality. Is there anywhere in, I mean, like Morningstar, whoever might do ratings, it's probably a stretch to sort of tie all this together, but political volatility that Alaska Permanent Fund is exposed to, and there's not a direct correlation because I don't think political volatility has made a difference yet.
Right.
It could. But does that factor itself into any sort of outside rating agencies' behavior towards the Alaska Permanent Fund?
At this point, I don't think so, because you're not a big borrower. The fund cannot go out and borrow directly and use the corpus of the fund as collateral. That's in the statute somewhere. I know there are other funds where that is allowed. So you're not really subject to a credit rating per se in terms of it affecting your operations.
Representative LeBond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I have a couple questions. And in the banking world, it's not uncommon. As a matter of fact, it's typical for investment decisions at a certain level to include the board. Does the Alaska Permanent Fund board play a role in investment decisions?
Yeah, the Permanent Fund board, and I'm not, I don't want to overstate my knowledge of the exact language in the investment policy statement, but the Permanent Fund board does determine the overall risk level. They determine generally the asset allocation, so how much should be in which bucket. They determine the bands around those buckets where, you know, if it gets out of whack, you've got to report back to the board, and the board has to, you know, do something about it. I think that investments above a certain size are also subject to board approval. And that may be the end of it, but I don't take that for gospel.
Just one follow-up then, Madam Chair. The board recently, the Alaska Permanent Fund Board, recently authorized, I believe it was $200 million to be placed with venture capital management firms, one in-state and one out-of-state. Do you have an opinion regarding that action?
Yeah. I guess my overarching opinion is that they did a good job, the permanent fund staff did a good job of outsourcing that process to an organization that specializes in in-state investment programs that is completely independent of the permanent fund staff. So I think it was a smart idea to take control of that portfolio out of the hands of someone who could be influenced politically and put it in the hands of somebody who's going to act like a good fiduciary and only make investments if they're going to earn money. So I think that it was done very professionally, I guess. The execution was very professional.
And if I could, Madam Chair, with a follow-up, regarding the transparency of that investment, how transparent should it be, and should Alaskans know how that money was invested? Should this committee know how that money was invested?
I think that it's public money, so I think that there always needs to be a degree of transparency. The only conflict that is sometimes created in private equity portfolios is, the managers of that portfolio are going to be in possession of sensitive information that could influence the outcome for the company if it was broadcast publicly. So I think there's a balance that can be struck between a reasonable amount of transparency and not hurting the investment or hurting the opportunity set. I mean, there are certain investments or companies where if they can choose between your money, where you have to reveal everything to the world, and someone else's money where you don't, you know, they're going to go for that money first and maybe make you have a slightly worse deal. So this isn't to say that lack of transparency is ever good in public finance, in my view, at least in our view. But I think that there can be reasonable rules placed around private equity investments that make sense for the investor and for the public. Is that too vague?
Thank you. Representative Josephson.
Yes, through the chair, and I only ask this, Mr. Allen, if you sort of can give us a quick answer, and if you know, because I don't want to try the patience of my colleagues. You mentioned in passing earlier in your presentation the ARM board. Does Callan have some work for the ARM board?
Yes.
And are you familiar with how the ARM board is, how those investments are doing?
Generally, I am familiar. I don't work on that account. My partner, Steve Center, actually is the investment consultant to that account. I don't know if he's online. The portfolios, is he available to make a comment? Steve, can I ask you to comment on the performance of RMB versus APFC?
Mr. Center?
Through the chair, yes, I am online.
If you could state your name for the record, please.
I do not have the ARM board materials in front of me either. I was really only prepared to speak about the permanent fund. What I can say is that the performance of the Alaska retirement system has been very strong, both on a relative basis and on an absolute basis. So very, very, very good performance over the last trailing 3, 5, and 7 years.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. And can you state your name for the record, please?
For the record, this is Stephen Center, C-E-N-T-E-R, and I'm with Callan.
Thank you very much. Representative Edgman.
So
permanent fund, I think, is just beginning its search to find an executive search agency to begin the search process for a CEO. But would you be shocked if there was no CEO in place if we have a meeting on December 31st of this year? Given as you stated earlier, you know, it's pretty difficult to get.
Yeah, well, I think that the CEO and CIO jobs at the permanent fund are extremely attractive jobs. You may not be able to hold on to those people for 20 years because they'll get their experience here and then they'll be really valuable somewhere else. But I think you can always attract people to both of those two jobs. I do think that you pay more than most public funds. I don't have the particulars of what everyone's paid, but my sense is that that's true. And again, this is a super prestigious. If you want to be in the investment business, the permanent fund is one of the best funds in the country to work with. It's just got a great track record. It does things the right way. It's got a non-political board for the most part. You can learn about private equity, hedge funds, U.S. equities, fixed income, international equity, currency. I mean, they've got something for everybody there. And so you get a lot of speaking engagements, or you're offered a lot of speaking engagements representing the permanent fund out there. So I don't think they're going to have trouble attracting candidates for that job. And I would be surprised if they haven't filled it by the end of the year.
Is a follow-up?
Yes, follow-up.
So it's pretty common then that other endowments pay performance bonuses to their upper management?
Yeah, endowments for sure. You know, if you look at you can probably just Google it and find out what Harvard paid to their investment staff, but it's in the tens of millions of dollars in performance bonuses, particularly when the markets have been really good like they have. So the college endowments in particular pay their investment people really well. The large ones have bigger staffs than, not only do they pay people more, but there are more of them than the permanent fund. You know, I'd say the permanent fund is sort of a medium to small sized staff relative to the large, you know, super endowments out there and the big sovereign wealth funds. Canada has a number of sovereign wealth funds and, you know, they tend to have big professional investment staffs. And they pay performance bonuses and pay more than the permanent fund does.
Thank you. Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I have a question regarding the presentation. Last couple slides were showing the worst case, best case scenarios long term. Can you talk to me just a little bit about what your assumptions were in regards to inflation? How was that factored in, and where was the money coming from to keep up with inflation in regards to the earnings?
Yeah, so I left in the appendix our capital market expectations, and I know that's a big, ugly-looking slide there, but if you kind of go third column from the right, the 10-year geometric return, inflation in our scenarios is, the middle is 2%. The way we model inflation, though, is that it trends. So even though the middle case is kind of 2% low inflation, there are scenarios in there where inflation spikes up and gets up into the 10, 12, 13% range for periods of time. When I was modeling the permanent fund, I did a similar presentation to the Board of Trustees back in December, and I discussed with staff, you know, what do we do about inflation proofing, you know, the practice of inflation proofing, appropriating inflation times the principal back into the principal. And I had turned off inflation proofing in that exercise for 2023 and 2024 on the theory that the $4 billion was kind of pre-inflation proofing. I was advised to turn it back on for this. So these results actually are a little worse than what I showed the Board of Trustees in the sense that the ERA was a little bit smaller because I think it called for about $1.3 billion in inflation proofing in 23 and 24. So inflation proofing in the model is built in there. It's taking whatever inflation was out of the ERA each year. Except we do assume that if you get to the end of the year and there's only enough money to pay the dividend, I mean, not the dividend, the POMV for inflation proofing, POMV wins. And in those years, you don't do any inflation proofing. So that's what's assumed in the model. I don't know if that's what would actually happen, but that's how it worked. Did that answer your question?
I think so. I'm going to follow up.
Yes, follow up.
Mm-hmm. So I guess the question in my mind is, if we're assuming that inflation is completely being paid for every year, then the question becomes, where's the money coming from in the assumption? Is it coming from the earnings, meaning there's less to spend of the POMV model because it's being eaten up by inflation, or it's coming from somewhere else and we're just making an assumption that inflation will be taken care of? And what I think I just heard you say is, if it's in the models, and I'm talking about all of the different Monte Carlo simulations, if it comes down to there's only a few dollars left, the POMV is going to win,
right?
Meaning state government is going to get its money, and inflation is just going to not be covered that year.
Right. So in those scenarios where the ERA runs out of money, it's going to get to a point where the POMV wants $3.5 billion and inflation proofing wants $1.3 billion, and there's only $3 billion. POMV gets all three, inflation proofing gets zero. So in those scenarios where it gets really bad, if those happen to coincide with positive inflation, then the principal is getting smaller on an inflation-adjusted basis.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And since we're talking about inflation, generally speaking, if you look at the last 10 years, have we kept up with inflation into the fund?
Yeah, so I'm going to go all the way back to here. So this is so the brown, if on, in the right column, the right set of columns, that's the last 20 years. The fund returned 8.03% annualized per year for the last 20 years. CPI plus 5. Inflation plus 5% was 7.18. So the fund has actually done CPI plus 6 over the last 20 years.
So as just one quick follow-up on the question of inflation, you're using, if I'm reading this chart right on page 46, you're using 2% then moving forward. What is the rate of inflation in your eyes today, and is that enough for the near term?
So inflation has gotten a lot of headlines recently. Supply chain issues, labor shortages, you know, have definitely driven up prices. Food, oil prices are up. I don't know if you guys noticed. So I think our economists and a lot of other folks believe it's the initial word that was used was transitory. In other words, it's going to be high for a little while, and then it'll work itself out of the system. There's still a lot of things sort of in favor of low inflation out there, global productivity growth, any number of other arguments. Two's probably, so to put this in perspective, we update these projections once a year. But we're looking at 10 years. They were two was our projection last year. We're coming all the way up to 2.25. So we are thinking inflation's a little higher than it was last year. and that's the middle case. Now, bear in mind, we're modeling these cases where inflation just takes off and trends up. Those are in there, but we don't ascribe a high probability to that. So we think the middle case is going to be lower for longer. We think the Fed is going to be hawkish on inflation eventually, and they'll do it in time, but there's a chance, you know. So, you know, 5% of those scenarios, that those 2,000, you get 10 years out and you have inflation that's over 10%. So those are in there, but they have a low probability.
Thank you.
Representative Carpenter.
Does your model, any of the Monte Carlo models, maybe it's just a byproduct, the high inflation numbers would be a byproduct of this, but the amount of money that our federal government is running through right now will have, in my opinion, and it's unqualified, will have some effect on inflation. And I hear you saying, and you have a very qualified opinion, that the probability is low that has a long-term impact to this. And from the layman's perspective, I don't understand that. The amount of money that we're printing,
right,
is historic,
yeah,
on massive levels.
Yeah.
And just to argue that it'll have a minimal impact on inflation, to me, doesn't pass a common sense test. Maybe it's just my understanding doesn't.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, nobody knows, right? That's the thing about the future. It's really hard to predict. And, you know, our process is we don't operate in a vacuum. So our guys, I have a whole capital markets team that does these every year, and we spend an inordinate amount of time arguing about whether inflation should be 2 or 2.25. But we're looking at, we get these consensus forecasts for all the big economic forecasting companies. We look at what the Fed's saying, obviously. We look at what other investment managers are saying. We look at what all of our competitors in the consulting industry are saying. And we don't want to be an outlier. We're not paid to, like, have a different opinion from everybody else, and maybe you're right, maybe you're wrong, and then we tell $3 trillion in client assets to go do something on our opinion. So I would look at our numbers as being kind of the collective thoughts of our industry, who are long-term planners for these big portfolios. 2 is probably on the low end. I'd say there's probably 60%, even 70% are going to be higher than that. But you're not seeing anybody where the midpoint of their inflation projection is 5%. That would be crazy talk in people's minds. Now, that doesn't mean we're not going to have a period of a year where we're going to have 7% inflation. That's totally in the realm of possibility. But this idea of sustained inflation, so that when you measure it over 10 years, it's 5% annualized, that's way high in the probability stack, at least looking out at the other forecasters out there. Now, you can read in the Wall Street Journal, though, there's plenty of people that are willing to say that we're going to have hyperinflation because of exactly what you just said and a number of other things. But I think that for every argument in favor of hyperinflation, there is some danger of deflation as well. So, I mean, you've got this giant demographic thing happening in the United States where people are going to start retiring at unheard of rates, and they're going to start saving, start spending a lot less than they used to. That's what happens when people retire. They get scared and they don't want to spend. They don't want to go to Europe. They're tired. That has an effect on inflation as well. And so anyway, there's a lot of forces out there. I don't pretend to be an inflation expert. I don't even think I could play one on television. But we have a bunch of guys that think 2.25 is reasonable as a midpoint.
Thank you. And just briefly before we adjourn, can you give us an explanation of the fee structure Callan charges to the permanent fund?
Sure.
And how you guys get paid?
Yeah, so we're hired on a retainer basis. So an annual retainer. We typically have to rebid that. Typically, I think every 5 years, they have to go out for a rebid and compete for the same business. I think they actually get a 2 1-year extensions on that 5 years. We're actually at the very end of our 1-year extension, so they're going to be going out and bidding out Callan's business in the first quarter or early second quarter of this year. So we will compete against the other firms that do this. We go over all the services that we provide, and so it's an annual retainer, and then we do charge for certain types of projects that aren't part of the retainer. So these things that sort of happen once in a while. So this modeling work is part of the retainer, our performance measurement process is part of the retainer, but sometimes we'll do a manager search where we have to go out and do this big extra process to go identify a manager. We'll charge a fixed fee for that. So that's our, in general terms, how our fee structure works.
That's helpful. Is there anything further from the committee? Representative Edgman?
Yeah, I don't mean to be on this one tracker, but so is Callan going to be advising on the CEO?
capacity?
I don't think so. The only way in which we have any input, I think, at this point is that we're making a presentation to the Board of Trustees on what the various governance models are out there. So I think the board is, even, you know, they're taking this opportunity to evaluate whether they have the best governance structure and what the role of the CEO versus the CIO versus the investment committee should be. And we always think it's good to dust off your governance structure every 5 or 6 years and make sure it still fits, so it's probably a good exercise. But that's really just us bringing in, here's what's going on with all your peers. But we're not in the executive search business, and so we're not going to be involved in the selection of the CEO in that way.
Yes, follow up?
So the trustees have the statutory authority as it exists now to actually overhaul the governance structure if they saw fit, right?
That's my understanding. I mean, typically the way that the governance structure works is it's memorialized in what's called an investment policy statement or a governance policy statement, which is a written document. The permanent fund has one. I'm sure it's on their website, where they lay out all the roles and responsibilities. And so the board typically has to approve any changes to an IPS, investment policy statement. So de facto, I think that means they have the ability to change things.
Yes, follow up?
Would you ever recommend to the trustees that they go forward without an executive director?
I can't see how you could do that. I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on at the permanent fund outside of investments that you would not want to distract the CIO with. And, you know, the CIO needs to be focused on investing. I think that's a really important point. And if the CIO has to figure out how to overhaul the website, or has to figure out how to hire people, or, you know, remodel the office. I mean, there's just a million things that go into running an investment organization of that scale and size. And I think you need an executive director. I think that executive director should probably be the chief communicator to stakeholders, like the legislature and the board. And you shouldn't burden the CIO with that, because he's got a complicated enough job as it is. Just managing all of the investment people and trying to get a good return out of the fund.
Great, thank you. Well, thank you, Mr. Allen and Mr. Center, for being with us today. We appreciate the presentation. Our next meeting is scheduled for tomorrow, January 25th at 1:30 p.m. At that meeting, we'll have a presentation on the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation from their acting executive director, Valerie Mertz. With that, at 4:27 p.m., we are adjourned. Thank you.